Hi, everybody. This is Marlene with Erie News, and today is May 1st, 2024, May Day, 2024. Today's a Tuesday, and let's get off to our first story out of Stranger Than Fiction stories. And this one is titled The Secret Attic. Sometimes years or perhaps decades pass before the fate of a person becomes known. Missing doesn't always mean dead, but in some cases, it most definitely does. The following is a complicated story of a woman's fate which took many years to come to light. In April 1920, a skeleton was found sitting in a dark corner of an attic. The building, located at 1333 North Capitol Avenue, had once been Union States Hospital, and before that, the Indianapolis Orphans Asylum. The bones were believed to be those of a patient named Carrie T. Salvage, who had last been seen on March 11, 1900. After Carrie Salvage had disappeared, the asylum was made into a rooming house and then was being remodeled to be used as a garage. The discovery made by a structural iron worker who tore the wall away so that a girder could be placed in position solved a 20-year mystery. The skeleton was clothed in a blue dress and slippers. These were identified by Joseph and Edward Salvage, who had given the slippers as a gift to their sister a short time before she disappeared. The reason for her death was initially unresolved. Some thought that due to her mental illness, she had hid in the attic and starved to death. Others believed she was murdered, even though the coroner could find no evidence of violence. Carrie Salvage, 44, was the oldest of six siblings born to an old and wealthy Indianapolis family. Before her mental breakdown, she had worked as a teacher at the public schools. On the morning of Carrie Salvage's disappearance, she had returned from a short walk with her private nurse. She asked her to go to the kitchen and get her some milk. When the nurse returned, she was gone. The disappearance of this patient caused the hospital to close its doors a week later. In order to find her, a considerable and costly search was made for her beyond Indianapolis. Nearby bodies of water, Fall Creek, and White River were dragged in the hopes of finding her body. A canal was emptied out. None of these efforts bore fruit. The discovery of her skeleton convinced her brothers she was left in the attic after she was murdered. Whoever killed her used the unusual construction of the building, which was a second attic reached by going through a door to the left of the main attic, then climbing over an inside roof and down to the right to the small corner where the remains were found. They said their sister was weak and half blind, and they couldn't believe she would have found this spot on her own. Many recalled a strange story in trial that took place only 2 years after Carrie's disappearance. In 1998, Rufus Cantrell was discharged from the United States Infantry due to epilepsy, which was followed by confusional and suicidal insanity that existed prior to his service in the military. In 1903, he was part of a case with ties to grave robbing and the murder of Doc Lung, a Chinese merchant who was killed in his laundry on Indiana Avenue. His head was almost severed from his body with a meat cleaver, which was found in the place. Doc Lung, real name Dong Gong Chung or Shun, was not just a simple laundryman. He, along with an associate named Pan Wing, went house to house to give customers opium hits from a pipe they brought with them. They were arrested in February 1895 and charged with conducting a traveling opium joint after they had gone to a house on West Market Street to give opium smoke to three women. During the trial, it was noticed the Chinese population in the city would have nothing to do with a mysterious man who identified himself as Japanese. He sat in the court proceedings and gave his name as T.Y. Shung. He said he was connected to the Japanese legation at Washington. He was dressed in Western clothes, along with four Christian Endeavor pins. His hair was long and straight, and his forehead was shaved. The Chinese claimed he was lying about his nationality. He said the Japanese minister wanted him to make a report upon the cases of Doc Lung and Pan Wing. The question was asked that with China and Japan at war, why did Japan interest itself in two Chinamen living in Indianapolis? The two men were fined $300 each, but did not go to jail. The presence of Mr. Shung was never explained. However, Doc Lung was not long for this world, because he was killed 7 years later in May 1902. His room was ransacked, and it was believed as much as $1,000 was taken. He always carried large sums of money and had recently won a fantan game at the conclave of the Masonic Order of China. Some believed he was killed by a highbinder. These were known as hatchet men or salaried soldiers of the Tongs associated with illegal immigration and prostitution. They used an odd mix of old world and new weapons, such as swords, knives, daggers, and clubs. They were also proficient in the use of a hatchet they had modified for their own use. The Chinese residents of the city denied that any highbinder had killed him because they would have become aware if any had entered the city. They believed he was murdered by a local robber for his money and refused to discuss anything further. Another fact that pointed the killer was not Chinese was that the coat and pants of the dead man were stolen. Detectives would go on to arrest Chin He, who had once worked for Doc Lung, indicating he knew how to open the register at the laundry and right after Lung's death had become flush with money, whereas before he was broke. He was, however, acquitted by the grand jury. Doc Lung's murder trial would eventually convict and sentence Nimbus Davidson and James Andrews, two associates of Rufus Cantrell, to lengthy prison sentences. Andrews would go on to be paroled in 1910. However, many dark deeds were disclosed during the trial. When Cantrell took the stand, he testified that he was once a trustee at the county jail, which damaged his credibility instead of enhancing it. He disclosed about a citywide network of grave robbers. Later, it would turn out he led a 40-man gang known as the Sign of the Cross. They were used to procure corpses for doctors in the city. A doctor would tell him specifically which corpse he wanted. Then he would pay Cantrell and the men who helped him $30 for each dead person. Cantrell's outfit was in competition with another body-snatching gang run by Wade Hampton West, a Confederate veteran who had been stealing bodies for a quarter of a century. The trade in dead flesh was so lucrative that it was determined that over 100 graves had been robbed during a three-month period. Cantrell inferred that if the truth came out, it would become pretty hot for some doctors connected with various Indianapolis medical colleges. He named Dr. Joseph Alexander, but omitted the name of Dr. Goethe Link, who was a student assistant in the Central College of Physicians and Surgeons. Supposedly, he was threatened that if he implicated anyone else, it would be brought to light that he had burked some of the bodies. In other words, he had killed individuals when he ran short of the recently deceased. The court was informed that Cantrell was warned against speaking about William Billy Moffitt. Cantrell didn't heed the warning and implicated Moffitt, who was arrested. Moffitt was a well-to-do citizen in Indianapolis, but it wasn't his wealth that protected him, but his connection to the Indianapolis Medical College. He had once only been a janitor at the college, and it turned out he had amassed his riches by robbing graves and floating them down the White River at night for the last 25 years. Eventually, 25 body snatchers were indicted, along with four doctors from the medical college, a funeral director, and saloon owner who stashed bodies in the basement. Cantrell testified he had obtained 11 bodies for Dr. Joseph Alexander, three of them from the insane hospital cemetery, and the rest from the German Catholic cemetery and other local graveyards. What made tongues wag was that bodies were taken from Crown Hill, a guarded cemetery where the wealthier families buried their dead. It proved that not only indigents ended up on dissecting tables. In the case of the asylum dead, the doctor told Cantrell he had fixed it with the undertaker and the hospital physicians for him to take the bodies. He would take the corpses to the basement of the Central College with other dissecting material. But it wasn't only doctors who tipped off the grave-robbing gangs, but ministers and funeral directors who passed on information so the corpses could be taken before rigor mortis set in. However, it wasn't only Cantrell's confession that brought the dark business to light. Family members were tipped off anonymously of the grave-robbing. One man discovered the body of his wife in a pickling barrel at the Central Medical College. Other bodies had been sold to colleges in Louisville, Kentucky, and Cincinnati. During the trial, based on Rufus Cantrell's description of the corpse business, Kerry Salvage's brother had four graves opened in the asylum cemetery in an effort to find her. By then, she had been missing for 3 years. Cantrell was taken to the cemetery and he pointed out the ones who were robbed. He said there was a grave where Miss Salvage's body would be found. Inside was a coffin with an upside-down lid and it was laid in a slanting position. The coffin was found as he described. However, the body inside did not belong to Kerry Salvage or Mary Stoops, who was buried there in October 1901. The body in the grave was only covered with a sheet, and the woman was wearing white slippers with high French heels. They weren't able to identify her. Of the other three graves, two had corpses, and one was empty. Joseph Salvage said he had no doubt the unnamed woman was taken from a medical college and placed there after the robbery of Mrs. Stoops' body, and that Cantrell hoped that he would identify the woman as his sister. Detectives also claimed that Cantrell deliberately planned the murder of Doc Lung and engaged other men to do the work and take the fall for the crime. Cantrell only received a short sentence on the charge of grave robbing since nothing else could be proven against him. At the conclusion of the case, the whereabouts of Kerry Salvage remained unknown. Cantrell faded from the headlines until 1909, when a story titled Grave Robber Has Reformed and Takes Bride, a Christmas Wedding, ran in a local newspaper. Upon being paroled from prison, he started to work at a mill and had taken a 17-year-old bride. However, Cantrell was too colorful a character to lead a humdrum life. By 1915, he had moved on to another wife and was running revival meetings as an evangelist for the Charity Army of America in Detroit, Michigan. His new wife was once married to a man serving a life sentence in Marquette Penitentiary, and her half-brother, Sonny Williams, was known as a safe blower. It seemed they came to the attention of authorities for their collecting activities. It wasn't until Cantrell, who was still referred to as the King of the Ghouls, came under police scrutiny once more that the name of Kerry Salvage surfaced again. He implicated a man who was arrested with him in Detroit. Cantrell said Elridge Gowdy killed Kerry Salvage after holding her in the basement of a house, and he was the one that sold her to the medical college. This was one of Cantrell's ploys, which was to give information about other crimes in order to detract from his own misdeeds. At this time, Salvage's body was yet to be discovered, and the Indianapolis police discredited Cantrell's story, claiming he had told a similar story in 1903, and he had led them on a wild goose chase to find Salvage's body. They claimed no evidence had ever been found that she had been murdered. Cantrell admitted under oath to being a part-time preacher, an undertaker, truck gardener, and confessed grave robber, but he vehemently denied having preached a funeral service and on the very next night digging up the body. This was a reference to the story that he was a pallbearer at his niece's funeral and later sold the body to the medical college. In 1916, for their troubles, Cantrell and Gowdy were sentenced to 2 years each in Marquette Penitentiary on a charge of larceny. Their scam involved frisking people's pockets while Cantrell conducted services in the Gospel Praise Mission. After this, Cantrell's name faded from the newspapers. No doubt he wanted no publicity about his death and his final resting place in case he would be dug up and examined to explain his psychopathology. However, after 50 years, his name was still synonymous with body snatching and was mentioned in a news article from 1957. It detailed the discovery that someone had tried to break into the tomb of Dr. Winthrop Foote, one of the early founders of Indianapolis, who died in 1856. Dr. Foote believed, like the ancient Egyptians, that when he died, he would need his horse, guns, ammunition, and other items for daily living to use in the afterlife, that is. He was buried in a three-room mausoleum with his brother Zeba Foote. The young man had graduated from Yale and drowned in Foote's grave pond in Posey County while conducting government surveys. The pond was named after him when his companions buried him next to the small body of water buried in the bark of a tree. In 1829, Dr. Foote, with the help of an old man named John Walter, found his brother's remains and brought them back to Bedford to a secluded graveyard known as Foote's Tomb. It was created by Dr. Foote when he found a large block of limestone had fallen from a cliff in a secluded valley on a piece of land he owned. He had a hole cut into the stone to create a vault. Zeba's epitaph read, "And by the buried bones of him whom living I loved best, see me at last lay quietly, then leave me to my rest." Police found Dr. Foote's body lay encased in a cast iron casket held together with nuts and bolts, shaped to the contour of his body. A leather bag was deteriorated, but a stone box containing guns he had buried with him was untouched. Only the first of the three rooms had been opened. The other rooms contained his horse and his brother's body. Authorities believed the robbers were trying to steal the firearms, which, due to their age, would bring in quite a bit of money. It seemed Dr. Foote anticipated the scourge of body snatching that swept through Indianapolis many years later and had made his mausoleum robber-proof. The dirty trade of human bodies predated the lurid court case of 1903. Case in point was the robbery of John Scott Harrison's body in 1878. He was the son of William Henry Harrison, first governor of the Indiana Territory and a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. His son Benjamin would eventually become president of the United States in 1889. At the same time of Harrison's death, William B. Devon, a young friend of Benjamin Harrison, died a few days before his father and was buried in the same cemetery. While attending the Harrison funeral, it was noticed that Devon's grave was disturbed and the grave was found to be empty. The Medical College of Ohio at Cincinnati, described as a body hole, immediately came under suspicion. Another Harrison brother, John, and a cousin, George Eaton, went to Cincinnati and searched the medical college. They saw suspicious behavior by a janitor on the fifth floor dissection room. A Cincinnati detective found a nude body hoisted up by a windlass and rope leading to a chute by the alley door. The corpse's face was covered. John Harrison said it was not the man he was looking for, since William Devon had died of consumption and he was emaciated by the time of his death. The detective insisted he look at the man's face anyway. Harrison was enraged to find that it was his recently buried father who had been stolen. Devon's body was found weeks later in a brine vat at Ann Arbor University in Michigan. Ultimately, it was never proven if Carrie Selvidge was murdered, even though there were rumors a man fitting Rufus Cantrell's description was seen putting her into a carriage. Supposedly, his gang came across her when they were leaving a cemetery after stealing a few corpses. At the gate of the graveyard, they were surprised by Carrie Selvidge, which commenced to scream. A few days later, they killed her and sold her corpse for $50 to a college. Once her body came to the dissection table, a medical student immediately recognized her as the missing woman whose picture was plastered across newspapers locally and nationwide. Instead of notifying the police, the college, which would have been in a difficult position of explaining how they had come by the corpse, instead disposed of her up in the attic where she was found 20 years later. Or perhaps the poor woman with her failing eyesight somehow managed to find a niche in the upper reaches of the house that for years remained unfound by anyone. How do you think Carrie Selvidge ended up there? Interesting, right? She's found 20 years later, and it's all tied in together with body robbing, and it all comes about because of that trial for Duck Lung. Because this guy Cantrell, every time he would get in trouble, he would start talking, he would give information like a CI about other people just to take the heat off of him. And it was never found out. Was she murdered? You know, things of that nature. Very interesting, you know. Talk about the good old days. All right, next story is also out of Stranger Than Fiction Stories, and this one is titled Better Late Than Never. On December 3rd, 1994, a troubled 26-year-old hired a pilot to take her out in a small Cessna for what she claimed was a trip to take aerial photographs. It turned out to be a trip into oblivion. The plane left Opa-locka Airport, and Christine Pascal had indicated an area close to her parents' home in southwest Miami where she said she wanted to take the photographs. It was only when the pilot felt a gust of wind and turned around that he saw her seconds before she leaped from the plane. It was then he realized what her real intentions had been all along. Hodelin F. Renee, the pilot, later explained to FAA investigators that they were flying about 5,000 feet in the air, and their eyes had met for a moment when he saw her intentionally throw herself out. Traveling at 120 miles an hour, her body met the ground in 15 seconds, assuring her death. Something the pilot did not know was that only days before, Pascal had tried to jump from another plane as it circled the same area. In this case, the pilot had spied she had unlocked her safety belt and returned to the airport after he guessed what she was trying to do. Ironically, Pascal had hoped to become a pilot herself, but a history of mental illness derailed her plans. She had obtained a license to fly a single-engine propeller-driven plane, which the FAA later revoked when they found she had lied about her medical history. The FAA believed she was dishonest, a schizophrenic, compulsive, and dangerous. Her personal life was marred by domestic disputes, mostly with her father. She had an arrest record for disorderly conduct, writing bad checks, fights with landlords, and also more serious incidents where she was charged with felonies. She didn't leave a note, but within a few days, she was set to attend court on a 1991 case where she had attacked her sister. She had violated probation twice, and it seemed there was a good chance she would do jail time. Over 20 years passed before Pascal's body was found in June 2017 in a 22-acre nature preserve. DNA eventually confirmed the bones were her. And I read a little bit more of that. Her parents, especially her mom, since her body was not found for so many years, believed that she had jumped out, but like with a parachute or somehow. In other words, that she hadn't died. She had done it intentionally and she ran away. And that's how she, you know, in other words, and I understand totally why she would think but that. But then the, I think her dad had already passed away by the time they discovered her body. I'm not sure if her mom had. And her sister, you know, with a DNA comparison, what was left of it, they confirmed that that was her. So, the next story is out of Daily Mail. It's titled, Scientists Cracks Cause of Pharaoh's Curse That Killed More Than 20 People Who Opened King Tutankhamun's Tomb in 1922. A scientist claims to have cracked the cause of the Pharaoh's curse that was believed to have killed more than 20 people who opened King Tutankhamun's tomb in 1922. Ancient Egyptian text threatens death by a disease that no doctor can diagnose to anyone who disturbs royal mummified remains. But Ross Fellows has suggested there was a biological reason behind the deaths. The study determined the cause was radiation poisoning from natural elements containing uranium and toxic waste that was deliberately put inside the sealed vault. Exposure to substances could have led to certain cancers like the one that took the life of archaeologist Howard Carter, the first person to walk inside Tut's tomb more than 100 years ago. The theory effectively proves that the tomb was indeed cursed, although in a deliberate biological way, rather than in a supernatural manner that has been suggested by some ancient Egyptologists. Carter died in 1939, likely of a heart attack after a long battle with Hodgkin's lymphoma, which impacts the germ-fighting immune system of the body, and radiation poisoning has been linked as a cause of the cancer. Lord Carnarvon, one of the men who also walked through the treasure-filled rooms, died from blood poisoning 5 months after the discovery. He suffered a severe mosquito bite, which became infected after a razor cut. Shortly after the tomb was opened, there was a short power failure and all the lights throughout Cairo went out. Carnarvon's son also reported that his favorite dog howled and suddenly dropped dead. Other people involved in the excavation died of asphyxia, stroke, diabetes, heart failure, pneumonia, poisoning, malaria, and x-ray exposure. They all passed in their 50s. British Egyptologist Arthur Weigel attended the opening of Tut's tomb, where he was accused of inciting the myth of the curse. He died of cancer at 54 years old. However, inscriptions found inside other burials throughout Egypt suggest the ancient people knew about the toxins. The text included areas were forbidden because of evil spirits. The study published in the Journal of Scientific Exploration explained that high radiation levels were also documented in Old Kingdom tomb ruins in two locations at Giza and in several underground tombs at Saqqara. The same conclusion was also found throughout the Osiris tomb at Giza. Fellows notes that intense radioactivity was associated with two stone coffers, especially from the interiors. Professor Robert Temple noted that the coffers were made of basalt, determining that they were a point of source of radiation as opposed to general trace natural levels or radon from the surrounding limestone bedrock. Other studies have directly measured radon gas at various locations and tombs at Saqqara. Radon gas is an intermediate product of uranium decay with a half-life of 3.8 days. Ambient radon concentrations were identified at six locations through the Saqqara ruins, the South Tomb, the Magazines of Djoser's Pyramid, and the Serapeum Tomb tunnels. Thousands of pots excavated under the Step Pyramid in the 1960s contained up to 200 tons of unidentified substances that have yet to be identified, suggesting toxins were buried with mummified remains. However, reported strong tradition as radon in tomb ruins has been loosely attributed to the natural background from the parent bedrock, fellows shared. However, the levels are unusually high and localized, which is not consistent with the characteristics of the limestone bedrock, but implies some other unnatural source. On November 4, 1922, Carter's group found steps that led to Tutankhamun's tomb and spent several months cataloging the antechamber. The team opened the burial chamber and discovered the sarcophagus in February the following year. The tomb is considered one of the most lavish to be discovered in history, filled with precious objects to aid the young pharaoh on his voyage to the afterlife. The trove of grave goods included 5,000 items, including solid gold funeral shoes, statues, games, and strange animals. The small size of Tutankhamun's burial chamber, given his standing in the Egyptian history, has baffled experts for years. Carter and his team took 10 years to clear the tomb of its treasure. The boy king was an Egyptian pharaoh of the 18th dynasty and ruled between 1332 BC and 1323 BC. He was a son of Akhenaten and took to the throne at the age of 9 or 10. When Tut became king, he married his half-sister, Ankhesenapaten. He died at around the age of 18, and his cause of death is unknown. The young king, however, was plagued with health issues due to his parents being brother and sister. A construction of his face and body showed the world a glimpse of what ailments he may have endured. King Tut had buck teeth, a club foot, and girlish hips, according to the most detailed examination ever of the ancient Egyptian pharaoh's remains. And rather than being a boy king with a love of chariot racing, Tut relied on walking sticks to get around during his rule in the 14th century BC, researchers say. A virtual autopsy composed of more than 2,000 computer scans was carried out in tandem with a genetic analysis of Tutankhamun's family, which supports evidence that his parents were brother and sister. The scientists believe that this left him with physical impairments triggered by hormonal imbalances, and his family history could also have led to his premature death in his late teens. Various myths suggest he was murdered or was involved in a chariot crash after fractures were found in his skull and other parts of his skeleton. But recently, scientists have suggested King Tut may have died of an inherited illness because only one of the breaks occurred before his death, and his club foot would have made chariot racing impossible. Hotan Ashrafian, a lecturer in surgery at Imperial College London, said that several members of the family appear to have suffered from ailments which can be explained by hormonal imbalances. Evidence of King Tut's physical limitations were also backed up by 130 used walking canes found in his tomb. I don't know why they have such the hormonal imbalance. All of this was suffered from ailments from incest. From incest. From a tradition of incest. Let's forget the hormonal imbalance. Yeah, there you go. So all this lavishness and there you know, it's very interesting as to what, how they would have known. Or if, well, maybe they knew it, but they couldn't understand how this radon gas actually worked. Maybe they just knew that if you were around it, you came down sick with something that would become incurable. So that's very interesting. All right. The next story is out of Stranger Than Fiction Stories, and this one's titled Legend Tripping Gone Wrong. A young legend tripper and ghost hunter was found dead in an abandoned church in Italy's Asota Valley. The condition of her body points to a sinister motive for untimely death. On April 5th, 2024, the 22-year-old told her family she was going ghost hunting when she left her village near Lyon. Police believe it might be connected to a TikTok stunt involving urbex of haunted locations. a local resident came across a decomposing body by the nave in a dark corner. There were marks next to the body indicating she was dragged inside. There were no signs of a struggle. She didn't have a cellular phone or any type of identification. Next to the body, police found some groceries and a bag of pink marshmallows bought at a local store. The autopsy of the body showed she had been stabbed in the abdomen and had a deep cut in her neck, which accounted as to why the body was drained of blood. The wounds were believed to have been caused by a camping knife, but could not be self-inflicted. She bled to death due to the wounds. There's conflicting information as to her being shot after she was dead. There's a theory she was sacrificed or consented to her own murder in the deconsecrated church. The police took a large stone with bloodstains on it from the scene. She was later identified by her parents as Ariane Natalie Lasney. Or Lasney. The suspect, Tema Soabi, 21, has been arrested, and it was found he already had a pending trial for acts of violence against the victim. There was also an international arrest warrant on him on charges of murder. He grew up in Italy of Egyptian origins, and he holds three citizenships, Italian, Egyptian, and Moroccan. He lives in the town of Saint-Priest in the Lyons area and was studying dentistry. There was an outstanding warrant for him since the end of March for violation of judicial control. There are two other missing person cases in the area which police are considering might be related. The woman with a male friend was seen walking around the area, both of them dressed like vampires or in the goth style. A witness told authorities the woman was pale, emaciated, and looked like a walking corpse. When discovered, she was wearing a sweatshirt, beige leggings, and a long dark coat. The small chapel dedicated to Santa Barbara was abandoned since 1879 when the villagers of Iquilivas sheltered there when a flood dragged boulders and trees through the town. The only other clue was a burgundy van filmed by a surveillance camera near the church the week before, and it's unknown if it's connected in any way to the crime. I'm following up on this because initially she was unidentified. Then they finally identified her, and apparently she had some type of relationship with this young man, but it was like she had an injunction against him. So I guess it was like a love-hate kind of relationship. And it's unknown if, at least he's been arrested on suspicion of murder. But talk about legend tripping going wrong. There you go. It's not where you go. It's who you go with. Okay. Next story is also out of Stranger Than Fiction Stories, and it's titled Lady in the Trunk, Mystery Solved. It was Halloween 1969, and St. Petersburg police was called to the scene of a gruesome murder. The body of a woman dressed only in a filmy green nightgown was discovered neatly wrapped in plastic bags and concealed in a black steamer trunk near the parking lot of the Oyster Bar restaurant at 4200 34th Street South. This case was recently solved in 2023 via DNA. Known as Trunk Lady, she was finally given her name. This is her story. Sometime between 1966 and 1967, Sylvia Atherton, 41, left Tucson for Michigan with her husband, Stuart Brown, along with her 40-year-old daughter, Kimberly Brown. Accompanying the couple was June's adult children, Gary Sullivan, and his 20-year-old sister, Donna, with her husband, Clarence David Lyndhurst. They were from Sylvia's first marriage to Harry Lee Sullivan. Sylvia's sister lived in Detroit, which explains maybe why she went up there. Her other children by a second marriage, Cillian 8 and Leonard 11, stayed in Arizona with her father. Leonard Cheney Smith. In the 1960 census, Sylvia still lived with her husband Leonard and her four children. Sylvia's son, Gary Sullivan, eventually went to live with his father. He, along with his two siblings, who stayed with Leonard Smith, lost contact with her, and they never saw their mother or sisters again after they moved. It was approximately 2 years after Sylvia Atherton Brown moved that St. Petersburg police made the gruesome discovery in a wooded lot next to the bar. Inside was a woman that appeared to be in her mid-20s, measured 5 feet 9 inches, and weighed 130 pounds. She was described as a statuesque brunette with brown eyes. Besides being strangled, she had been beaten around her head and shoulders. Her dark hair was in rollers. She was lying on her side and had a towel wrapped around her head. She had been dead 2 or 3 days and appeared to have head trauma. She still had a thin bolo tie around her neck. Further signs of trauma were hard to discern due to the state of decomposition of her body, However, her cause of death was later determined to be strangulation. Her fingerprints, dental records, and the trunk were sent to the FBI. It was determined she had not been raped, but at some point had given birth to a child. Despite her age, she wore a partial dental plate for her two front teeth and two side teeth. Six other teeth had been extracted. Initially, authorities were hopeful that due to her extensive dental work, a dentist in the area could help identify her. Later, Sylvia's son would go on to verify the steamer trunk her body was found in was used as a TV stand when the family lived in Tucson, Arizona. Police have no explanation why Atherton had come to the St. Petersburg area. The only clue police had was information from witnesses who told them they had seen two men in a pickup drop off the trunk and take off. Her identity has left other mysteries unsolved. One is why she was never reported missing, and where are Sylvia's two daughters, Donna and Kimberly? Sylvia's third and last husband, Stuart L. Brown, was living in Las Vegas, Nevada when he died in 1999, age 76. There was no reference on his death certificate of a wife or child. Whatever secrets he had about the whereabouts of his wife, daughter, and stepdaughter died with him. Most importantly, the answer as to what happened in those last 30 years of his life when his wife and her daughters disappeared as if the earth had swallowed them. Stuart L. Brown had divorced his first wife, Anita, in 1959 while they lived in Arizona, where he owned Bunny's Joke Shop. By February 1972, almost 3 years had gone by and no matches had been made with her fingerprints or dental records. There were no leads from a family member or witness. Without a name, the opportunity to apprehend her murderer became more remote. The police then had a sketch drawn and published it in the local papers in an effort to finally give her a name. The months and years rolled by, and the tall brunette, who had been buried in a pauper's grave at Memorial Park Cemetery in November 1969, remained a mystery. It was almost as if she had not existed prior to her body being found inside the trunk. In February 2010, her body was exhumed with the hopes that DNA might finally give her a name. By then, the Oyster Bar had been demolished, and the area had changed considerably. Sergeant Bill Carlisle, 83 years old and retired, was present at the exhumation by USF anthropologists, just as he had been when her body was found 41 years earlier. It's not clear what happened to the hair and skin samples and why it took so long for them to be processed, but it wasn't until 2023 that a comparison was made to her children's DNA, which confirmed her identity. The cold case unit contacted Cillian Gates with her findings. Cillian is the daughter, which now had the surname of Gates. The cold case unit contacted Cillian Gates with her findings and learned that her sisters, Kimberly Brown and Donna Sullivan Lyndhurst, who lived with their mother, have never been heard from since. Cillian said she had not heard of St. Petersburg until Donna left a message with a grandparent because she thought her brother was killed in the Vietnam War. The family never heard from her again. Undoubtedly, if they are still alive, they could explain what happened with their mother after the mid-1960s and how she came to be a murder victim in Florida. So here, you know, we have, apparently, she might have not been there that long in Florida, and she had moved from across the country, which is why they probably, remember, this was a time where jurisdictions couldn't share information as well as they do now. So, of course, when they tried to find a local dentist, you know, she wasn't local. I don't think she had been there long. The question is, who killed her? And why didn't her husband, her last husband, you know, what happened? Did she leave with the daughters and he just took off? Or he never contacted any of her children to say, hey, you know, sorry, but you, me and your mom, we broke up. And like everybody just went their own ways. Was he involved or did he know anything? Did she leave? And by the way, when you look at the dates, I believe she was having an affair with this gentleman while they were both married, because they had their daughter in 1961. And the 1960 census, she was still living with her second husband. So I believe that they and he divorced. And in other words, he divorced in 59. In 1960, she still living with her second husband. She has four children. And then in October of 1961, she has a daughter with, they had married, and she has a daughter with Mr. Brown. So I think there was shenanigans going on there. But anyway, it doesn't really matter, because at the end of the day was like, what happened to this lady and what happened to her two daughters? I mean, considering that she was unknown, but once her identity was established, comes to light. And again, you have siblings that nobody's ever heard from them again. You would think that they would want to, or that your mother drops out of sight. And then, you know, in other words, there's a dynamic there that's kind of weird, where you don't hear from your mom 2 years after she moves away, like your mother, your sisters. I don't get that part. Anyway, let's go on to the next story, also out of Stranger Than Fiction stories. This is titled The Body Under the Lilac Bush. All right. And this is in August of 1900. It was reported that a mansion known as the Page House was haunted by a white lady. For over 100 years, it was a famous inn in Fayette County, Pennsylvania. All right. The Page House, as it was known for over a century, faced Main Street. It was a stone structure with unusual pyramidal chimneys. Spiritualism never flourished in Connellsville, Pennsylvania, and most people dismissed stories of ghosts. But all this changed when the occupants of Page House, a one-time stone tavern styled in colonial architecture, became the scene of a ghostly visitation. Samuel Page, the first proprietor of the inn, described that one stormy night in 1814, a mysterious couple arrived. They traveled in a chaise with outriders, and they appeared to be people of wealth. They ate their supper in the front room on the second floor, which overlooked the big garden. The next morning, the innkeeper found they had disappeared without paying for the food or the room. Without a register, there was nothing to indicate their identity. Nothing more was known of the woman, but hidden under the lilac bushes by the front room, the body of a man who had been stabbed in the heart was found. Nothing could be found to identify him. The mystery of his murderer remained unsolved. Eventually, the public room was converted into two homes, and in 1900, one of them was occupied by Amanda Kerr, who lived with her brother and daughter. William Rowan, with his wife, three children, and his brother, lived in the other. Starting that summer, both families found that someone had dug up the garden, overturning the boardwalk and cutting up the lawn. The most disturbance was around the old lilac bushes, but it was the strange noises in the house that brought the most fright to the families. One day, John Grindle, Amanda Kerr's brother, was lying on a couch on the back porch. It was dusk when he heard steps on the boardwalk. This was followed by the howls of a strangling dog. Then Amanda Kerr shrieked from the porch, "Look, look!" Up the boardwalk came a tall, slender figure of a woman with a shroud folded over her face. Her head was bowed as if she were searching for something on the ground. Every few steps she stopped to feel the ground with her foot, and other times stopped and searched the grass with her hands. Amanda Kerr fled into her home, but her screams had brought both families out, where they stood in panic-stricken silence before the strange figure. Grindle asked, "What do you want here?" The ghostly figure didn't answer, but made a sound like a piercing sob that caused everyone to shudder. The ghost retraced its steps down the boardwalk, all the time pointing at the ground. Grindle asked again, "In the name of God, speak and tell me what you want." This time the ghost answered, "Help me find the body of my husband. I killed him up there in that room, and his body I threw down here in the garden. Come with me to seek the body." The ghost continued and crossed the lawn and stopped by the lilac bushes. The sound of something falling into a pool caused the ghost to disappear. Near the old Page House is a spring where the skeleton of a man was found a few months before. He was buried 20 feet deep, and none could explain its presence there, since this had never been a cemetery. Dr. Atkinson examined the remains and declared they were buried many years before and did belong to a man. Now it's believed the murdered man killed many years ago was the skeleton. Nothing more is known about the ghostly visitation, and if they stopped after that night, or if the guilty lady drove the inhabitants out of their home. Now what's really interesting about this story is, yes, this couple, and his innkeeper finds this dead guy in the lilac bush, and of course, but instead of, I don't know, instead of calling the police, the sheriff, or something, He goes and he buries his body in secret. And there's something there. There's like something here that's missing. All right, why they he would just keep it a secret and bury the 20 feet down, whatever. That still. There you go. And then this other next story, also out of Stranger Than Fiction Stories, is titled Lake Worth's Mysterious Creature. The summer of 1969, three couples had parked by a clearing on the shores of Lake Worth, Tarrant County, Texas. A favorite hangout place for the teenagers of the area changed on the night of July 9th when a beast straight out of a horror movie jumped on top of one of the automobiles and tried to grab one of the girls through the open car window. They sped away before it could pull her out. Dubbed the Lake Worth Monster, the 7-foot creature grabbed the headlines once police opened an investigation based on the incident reported by the witnesses, who seemed genuinely scared. One witness described it as having a head like a man, ears like a goat, a back like a dragon, one horn, and scales. Based on this description, it was alternately known as Goat Man. Monster fever brought not only onlookers and reporters, but hunters as well, and the police found their hands full trying to keep peace. On July 10th, a group of people gathered at a clearing near the lake when the monster was sighted on a cliff. It picked up a target with a rim attached and hurled it 500 feet. Sheriff's deputies, who were among the crowd, did not wait to see what else it would do and ran away with the rest of the onlookers. Reporter Jim Mars wrote a story in September 1969 when another sighting was made of the Lake Worth Monster. It had last been reported on July 11th, but according to a witness he interviewed, it had never left the area. The week before, six teenagers parked near Greer Island at a spot known as the Pit and saw it leap out of some trees and land only 5 feet away from them. According to Sally Ann Clark, who authored the book The Lake Worth Monster, it had been sighted for at least 20 years. It was known to kill sheep, accost fishermen, and had been seen eating fish. She claimed to have seen it 4 times after the summer of 69. In October of 1969, a man named Alan Plaster took a picture of the Lake Worth Monster, which is the only evidence of the creature. Captured is a large creature with light-colored fur. Eventually, Sally Ann Clark got the picture, which became part of her self-published book. Throughout the summer, many claimed to see it running through the landscape, and dead sheep were found. Police insisted it was either a bobcat or the work of a prankster. It was usually sighted between midnight and 4 a.m. Among the numerous people who claimed to see or hear the creature, one was Fort Worth Police Sergeant A.J. Hudson, who witnessed when it threw a tire at their cars. He said Tarrant County Sheriff's deputies, who had scoffed at the idea, changed their mind when they heard it howl. There were serious events taking place the summer of 1969. Troops were being withdrawn from Vietnam by President Nixon. Neil Armstrong would be the first man on the moon, and Mary Jo Kopechne would die under mysterious circumstances when the vehicle she shared with Senator Edward Kennedy veered off a narrow wooden bridge into Chappaquiddick Island Pond. Perhaps this is why the country was ready for a crazy story about a strange creature that howled piteously and traipsed through the woods in the dead of night. So there you go. There you have it. Eerie news for a May Day in 2024. I will be back soon with more interesting stories. Until next time.